Hey, it's been, I think, 3 weeks. It's been a little bit of time, so let's remind ourselves where we were and where we are going. We were discussing the Rambam, and we will be going toward the Rambam again, hopefully for not more than 2 more weeks, so we can wrap this up and move on to not just our next personality, but really the next phase in Jewish history, in medieval Jewish history that we will be looking at, which is going to be the transition to Christian Spain. Jews in Christian Spain as opposed to Jews in Muslim Spain. But within the course of our discussion of the Rambam, we already outlined his biography. We discussed his at some length his some of his earlier works, his commentary to the Mishnah, both from a halachic perspective as well as a philosophical one, and added literary perspectives as well. We discussed his Sefer HaMitzvot, and we've begun to discuss his Halachic Compendium, the Mishneh Torah. Last time, we analyzed the introduction of the Rambam in terms of his core purpose, the near seemingly radical intentions of the Rambam, really to rewrite the course of the history of Halacha as sort of a last-ditch effort, in his view, to save a tradition that was in danger of being lost due to external enemies that had been brutally inflicting suffering on our people. The Rambam sees this as a potential catastrophe. He's a modern-day Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, just as Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi responded to the crises of his time and the potential for the loss of our tradition, of our Torah Shebaal Peh, oral tradition, by setting it down to writing. So too, the Rambam sees this as a watershed moment, and he is going to single-handedly attempt to save our tradition by reorganizing, restructuring the entirety of Torah Shebaal Peh in this brilliant work. It takes him 10 years to compose the Mishneh Torah, and in doing so, he, by simplifying the tradition, by boiling it down to its sort of bare-bones facts in a way that is straightforward, clear, pristine Hebrew, that erases the arguments, not because we don't believe that arguments have validity, but at a time of crisis when we don't know whether or not we can sort of hold on to these, right to the core of our tradition, we have no choice but to put aside that which is at least somewhat extraneous and just focus on the essence, or that which in the Rambam's view at least cannot but be set down to writing. The Rambam's single-handed heroic attempt to save the tradition from these pernicious forces, including all those who would not agree to his project, aroused the ire and fury of his contemporaries. And we saw that the Ravid kind of gives the Rambam a little bit of a hard time. And he says, really? Really? Like, so all the other opinions like mine don't matter anymore. And all the other views that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi put in his Mishnah, right, in the Mishneh Torah, not really. We don't really need that there. Really? Is it really true that, you know, without you, all is lost? Is it really true? As you wrote in a letter, the scholars of Lunil, Southern France, the Rambam, is it really true that we can really, do we not have to learn Gemara anymore? Do we just skip straight to the Rambam, right? Mm-hmm. All of Shas, right? Right? You just take it off our bookshelves, right? And we should just, right, instead of teaching, instead of having Gemara class, we should actually just call it Rambam and save ourselves the trouble. I don't know, bring it to the education committee or something. So, right, I mean, is that really the suggestion? Are you really radically rewriting our school curricula, our tradition, and so on? So the Rambam, ironically, by seeking to sort of move beyond, to supersede all the controversies of previous generations, ironically, the Rambam, of course, spurs some of the greatest debates that we've ever seen. And so this is the great irony of the Rambam's attempt to bring everything together and to solidify and to, in a sense, simplify the tradition and to bring greater unity and unanimity. Of course, it's that very attempt which spurs so much debate and so much argument. And in a sense, we're appreciative of that nowadays because it's brought us so much richness and depth to our Mishnah, in the sense that the Rambam became a primary text around which there are so many rich and fascinating debates. I'm preparing a shiur for the students this morning, and so the question is how to count the Shemitah years and all sorts of intriguing debates between the Gaonim and the Rambam. The Rambam seeks to take a certain position, and it just becomes not just a commentary on the halacha, but it becomes a primary source in of itself, which stirs so much discussion and debate in its own right. It's just brought so much richness. Of course, that was far from the intent of the Rambam, but sometimes history knows best.
But the downside,
maybe it was Hashgacha Pratis.
Well, at the time, though, it was It was
couldn't help myself.
It was it bordered on a schism within Judaism. I mean, it got to the point. So we can look back now and say, sure, it was healthy debate, and we benefit from that healthy discussion back then. But at the time, there was a real fear that there would be this great schism within Judaism.
So
that's two camps.
That's a great point. I agree that it wasn't pleasant and it wasn't fun at that time. But I would say, if we're talking about true schism in the sense of really different communities, that was more a function of the Rambam's philosophy rather than his halacha. I mean, this got an extremely antagonistic reaction, but I don't think it threatened true schism in that larger sense of the term. It was more about his philosophical or Aristotelian ideas and the claims of heresy. This is not a claim of heresy so much as a claim of sheer arrogance and so on and so forth. So that's where I think that goes. Anyhow, the Rambam is clearly, for the Rambam, a literary masterpiece. He clearly intends it as such. He self-consciously writes in what he calls Ivritnikiya, essentially, extremely simple, clean, elegant Hebrew. And it's very clear that he expended a tremendous amount of time and energy, not only first and foremost clarifying the halakha, but also thinking through structural questions, how to organize it, and so on. Last time we outlined the 14 books of the Rambam, I kind of brought them here, starting with Sefer HaMitzvot, so it wouldn't count. That's sort of, as I said last time, in a sense, an introduction, that's sort of the skeleton of the recapitulation of the oral law. Appears in the Sefer HaMitzvot. You have the skeleton of 613 commandments, and then if we unpack those together with the rabbinic law, rabbinic codes that elaborate or that accompany each and every one of those biblical sets of halachot, so then ultimately what we have is a full framework of the Torah Shebe'al Peh. But again, he begins with Sefer HaMadah, the first of the 14 books, Madah having to do with correct beliefs from the word Yeda, from correct knowledge or beliefs in God, Ahava, all the mitzvot that are dedicated to leading toward the love of God, Zmanim, or the holidays, Nashim, our laws of ritual marriage, and so on and so forth. Kiddusha includes the laws of prohibited relations as well as kashrut, so hilchot machalot asurot, prohibited foods, as well as hilchot shechita, how to prepare kosher, otherwise kosher animals to be eaten properly. Kiddusha is the shortest of the svarim in terms of the number of subsections. It has three. That's the shortest of them all. Hafla'ah, having to do with vows, so a neder, a shavuah, someone who accepts a Nazirite oath, and so on and so forth. Zra'im have to do with Shemitah, for example, Truma, Maser, etc. All the laws dependent on the land of Israel. Can you see, Lisa? Whatever. Okay. Sorry. Avodah, what? You can't say anyway. Okay, now the real answer. Avodah having to do with the laws of the Kohen's worship in the Beit HaMikdash. Korbanot, more focused on the actual categories of sacrifices. Tahara, so laws of purity and impurity. Nizikin, torts, damages, discussed in Masechet Bava Kama. Kinyan, modes of acquisition, halakha. Mishpatim, various halachot that are associated mostly with monetary law. So laws of sending a messenger or contract law, laws of shtarot and so on and so forth appear there. And then finally, shoftim, laws of judges. So these are the 14. There's been a tremendous amount of ink spilled as to why the Rambam chose these categories, why the Rambam did not accept, for example, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's six categories. Right? He has Shas, is divided into those six sections of the Mishnayot. Why does he create a new superstructure, which is an interesting discussion, and why in this order? We're not going to go through all of that, but you can start to see some sort of structure in the sense that clearly the first two books in particular are foundational, right? So you have one in terms of proper beliefs, second in terms of developing sort of more, if it's more of an affective or emotional aspect. How do I then, once I know who God is and what the basic core beliefs of Judaism are, so then how do I connect with him and how do I relate to him in a way that is religiously edifying? After that, it gets a little bit less clear, and there are discussions as to why this is. I just saw a recent article that was suggesting, claiming that sort of there's almost a sense in which there are, first starts with what he calls sur me ra, in order to avoid temptations or things that can distract us or get in the way of our relationship with God. So if we eat certain foods that might, you know, if we're overindulgent, or we engage in incest or otherwise immoral behavior and so on and so forth, that can distract us. That can be a negative force in terms of our relationship with God, and that would be one. And then he moves from there to more positive opportunities, in a sense of not just sur meira, moving away from bad, but also asay tov, connecting in a more positive sense. So that might be starting with the recognition that God is responsible for everything in terms of Zeraim, and our sense of dependency upon God, moving to the sacrifices, talking about the notion of worship, Tumah v'Tahara, which is also a more esoteric kind of dimension of worship. It's not perfect at the end here in terms of interpersonal relationships. That's what these seem to be clustered here. Nizikin, Kinyan Mishpatim, having to do again with torts, damages, contract laws, etc. But maybe the point is that that is part of our relationship with God. A relationship with man is perhaps important as well. And then Shoftim also adjudicating those kinds of debates. That's possible. We don't really know for sure. The Rambam gives an introductory pasuk to each of these books. So it's worth analyzing each of those, and you can do this forever. In fact, it's fascinating. And it's really rich to think about, because it's clear that the Rambam put a tremendous amount of mental energy into the structure, and there's so much there, but that's in terms of the larger structure. Now, just to give a sense as well, there are so many levels of this conversation, and each one is intellectually stimulating and really enlightening. So, for example, there are questions as to not just the larger structure of the Sefer, but the theme and the structure of each of these 14 books, and why the Rambam places certain sets of halachot in each of these, and why he ordered them in the way that he did. So, for example, I mentioned the book of Kiddusha, which is the short. And it's interesting. And the Rambam actually has a comment in which he seeks to justify why these three categories, right? We have incest, shechita, and machalot asura, prohibited foods, why those are all associated with the concept of kedusha. And what does kedusha really mean for the Rambam? The Rambam, probably for him, the Rambam is not an ascetic, but he's also not of the school of thought, let's say a Hasidic school of thought, that the material has inherent religious potential. The Rambam doesn't seem to go in that direction. He's a little bit more, if you want to call him sober, rational about those kinds of things. He seems to see these things as kind of distractions that are necessary in order for us to, or even means to an end. In other words, we should be healthy, not because the caretaking of our body is inherently significant, but because we can begin to imagine the possibility of connecting to God if we're not physically properly balanced. As an aside, the Rambam's medicine and modern medicine have much in common. The Rambam was really ahead of his time, especially this issue of balance for the Rambam in terms of our diet and so on and so forth, and physical exercise, all these kinds of things. The Rambam was really remarkably prescient. I don't mean to say you should treat patients on the basis of you'd want the Rambam's actual medical prescriptions, but it is remarkably ahead of its time. And so you have these kinds of discussions. One of the most interesting ones is in the book of Shoftim, which is the last one. And to me, that's one of the most intriguing books in all of these, because the Rambam starts with the laws of judges, and he goes on from there. I'll give you the different categories within Sefer Shoftim, just as an example of how the Rambam, by simply placing a set of halachot in a particular context, radically rewrites, arguably, the meaning of entire categories of Jewish law, just simply based on nothing he says necessarily, but just simply the placement of that set of halachot, that means to tell us something profound about the significance of that area of law for the Rambam. So for example, in Sefer Shoftim, he starts with the laws of the Sanhedrin. Okay, he's talking about courts. Makes sense. You start with the laws, right? Shoftim, judges. You start with the laws of Sanhedrin. That's pretty straightforward. He then comes to the laws of testimony, Ilchot Edut. Also, talking about judges, testimony, that makes good sense, fits right in. Then it starts to take an interesting turn. Third section in Sefer Shoftim is Ilchot Mamrim, the laws of those who are rebellious. So for example, this is the Zaken Mamre. This is the rebellious elder who insists upon ruling against the final codification of the Sanhedrin. This is the basis for the law of the Sanhedrin, for its authority. This is the prohibition against cursing a parent. This is the Ben Sorero Mora, the way where child appears here. Hilchot Mamrim. Sefer Shoftim is already an interesting context. And the notion that he has the laws of the rebellious ones is a really interesting, I wouldn't have thought to make a, right? It's like, it's like the Russia and the Haggadah, I don't know. It's interesting. Then, number four, which is really seems out of place, is, believe it or not, Hilchot Avel. Laws of mourning. Truth is, the laws of mourning have no obvious place in any of these books. If you go back through all 14, there's no obvious candidate for the laws of mourning. Which one is it? Mada? Philosophy, basic beliefs? Right? Is it Ahava, love of God? Is it Zmanim? Is it, maybe it's Zmanim, but Zmanim is usually holidays. It's more celebratory. Nashim is, right, laws of marriage, Kedusha, sanctity. Hafla, vows, Zraim is, right, mitzvot associated with the land of Israel, avodah, korbanot, sacrifices, tahara, right, and so on and so forth. If you go through Nizikin, Kidyan, Mishpatim, none of these seem to be a great context for the laws of mourning. But still, it's fascinating that he puts the laws of mourning in Sefer Shoftim. What's that all about? And then, the last section is called Hilchot Melachim, laws of kings. And intriguingly there, he discusses the mitzvot of Gentiles as well. That's where he discusses the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, as well as the other obligations of Gentiles and some laws regarding our interaction with Gentiles. And then the final two chapters of the entirety of Mishneh Torah, at the end of Sefer Shoftim, at the end, conclusion of Hilchot Melachim, chapters 11 and 12, discuss Mashiach. Actually how he concludes, and all sorts of fascinating chidushim about how he sees that era, how we are to halachically determine whether or not a messianic claimant is in fact legitimate.
Yeah, that's very controversial, his position.
Highly. And of course, but it's also one that everyone wants to claim for themselves. So what's also interesting is the reinterpretations that you find of the Rambam. So for example, just to give one interesting one, the Rambam says that that one of the characteristics of the Melech HaMashiach is V'yilachem Melchamot Hashem. He will fight the wars of God. So there have been groups at various points in our history that wanted to claim a particular individual as a Mashiach. Only problem is he was a scholar rather than a warrior. He wasn't a Bar Kokhba or someone like that, right? Or a King David, right? He was sort of that, someone who's a Hasidish Rebbe or something, or whatever. So what do you say? No, V'ilachem l'chamot Hashem is metaphorical for someone who fights the good fight, which is lovely, except then the Rambam goes on to discuss the candidacy of Bar Kokhba and so on and so forth. It doesn't really sound that way, and so on. So there have been some fascinating, because for better or for worse, the question of who is the Messiah has not been a merely theoretical question in our history, but is a very, very real question which has dramatic ramifications for our entire mindset and for where we focus our energy as communities, and not just now, during the medieval period. And there were many really painful instances of this, including the Rambam's life himself. He therefore writes this book. Remember, he gets Igaret Teiman from a devastated community that had a messianic pretender who then converted to Islam. Hmm. And imagine
similar to Shabtai
the trauma, Tzvi. very similar to what happens later. Yeah. And we know about Shabtai Tzvi, we know the level of trauma, right? That, 100 years later, there were rabbis who were opposed to Chassidut because they thought this is the second coming of Shabtai Tzvi. Mm-hmm. It's 100 years, we're talking about multiple generations later, mm-hmm. but those scars remained wide open for a very long period of time. Mm-hmm. So absolutely. Mm-hmm. So the structure of Sefer Shoftim is interesting, and it's one of the more unusual ones. Why does he put the laws of mourning here? Why the laws of kings here? And why does he close with Yimot HaMashiach? There are all sorts of interesting discussions. How does the Rambam view the laws of mourning? And what does that reflect about sort of putting it in Sefer Shoftim next to Hilchot Mamrim, and so on and so forth? And there are different explanations for it and different theories, but it's possible that for the Rambam, there's another dimension of Avilut, which I don't know if it's a very popular one or would be popular nowadays, but still interesting, where the Rambam sort of sees it as a way of the way in which we mourn for different members of society maybe reflects something about the hierarchy of society. And the hierarchy of society is really the larger theme of Sefer Shoftim, which is about maintaining a healthy sense of hierarchy in society. Because if we maintain a well-ordered society, so then, both in life and in observing those who have passed, so then we can create in our living the kinds of society that we seek to create. And maybe that's really why Kibbutz Avaim and the laws of the rebellious elder and the rebellious child, those are all here, because those are really about sort of creating a well-structured society, a respectful, appropriately hierarchical society that we wish to cultivate. There are theories along these lines, and it fits nicely with other thought of the Rambam. I'm not sure all thinkers would prefer to think about Hilchot Aveilut as primarily about creating hierarchies or structures in society, but that rubs me in an interesting way. But
it connected to what you just said, though.
Yeah, go ahead.
In the world, that notion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, really, what we're trying to do in all of this is to then, in turn, foster a society which is geared toward these ultimate goals of connecting, etc. So it's part of his larger system, and there are then even local halachot in the laws of Avel that only make sense if we understand mourning in this sort of way. Really interesting. Even his theory of honoring parents, I think, fits into this. There are different theories as to the basis for Kibbutz Avaim. Some suggest that it's really interpersonal in the sense of gratitude to my parents for having brought me into the world as well as for everything they gave me subsequently. Others say, really, Kibbutz Avaim is immediately about my connection with my parents, but that really becomes a metaphor then for my relationship with God, and that's why Kibbutz Avaim appears on the first side of the Ten Commandments. On the second side, if you think about the first side, is all between man and God. Right? And the second one is Bin Adam L'Chaveiro. It's between man and fellow man. And that's why it's on the first side, because there's this divine dimension. By connecting to my parents, I implicitly give honor and show that honor to that gratitude toward God. The Rambam's theory seems to be an interpersonal one for Kibbutz Avaim, but not so much the gratitude, but rather respecting parents who have appropriately raised me is part of seeing myself and cultivating that kind of society which will lead to people being able to work together to achieve those larger goals that we spoke of. So that's probably why he places Kibbutz Avaim here, and that has to do with a lot of his theories in Moreh Nevuchim as well. So you start to see that even just the location of the Rambam and where he puts certain halachot reflects an entirely coherent and comprehensive worldview, which is simply reflected by not a word that he wrote, but rather where he wrote it, which is just remarkable. Even his Hilchot Yemot HaMashiach at the very end has to do with his larger theory as to what life is all about. Because for him, the Messianic era is basically about intellectually cleaving to the divine. And that's what he says, that in Bein Olam Hazeh L'Yemot HaMashiach El Shibud Malchiyot Bilvad, it's not going to be a radically reordered era. It's not like we're going to, we're going to go over to the trees and there's going to be, green, right? Money really will grow on trees. Or that the lion and the lamb, we'll be looking at the pasture over there. Look, it's the lion and the lamb. They're lying together. Wow, that's so cute. Right? What a messianic moment. It's not that. It's a metaphor for the Rambam, right? And it's a metaphor for we won't have external pressures. We won't have enemies seeking to annihilate us or even to hurt us in any way, so that we can be freed up to just connect with God and to do all that important work. So for the Rambam, the way that he concludes really brings full circle the larger purpose of life. A messianic era is really the ultimate opportunity to live this halachic lifestyle, which all these halachot are meant to foster. It's a teleological view of the mitzvot, meant to bring us to the purpose of divine connection, creating that society. That's really where Yemot HaMashiach fits in as well. And so what emerges in addition, as we discuss it, is that you can see that it's not just the structure of the book that's fascinating and that's telling, so the literary piece to it, but Also, what the Rambam is attempting to do is not just to codify halakha, but he's also seeking to do is to weave Jewish philosophy and Jewish law into one coherent picture. This is not a book of law, whereas the Moreh Nevuchim is a book of philosophy. Far from it. This is a book of law and philosophy, because for the Rambam, to some degree, they are one and the same. The purpose of the mitzvot is for us to access those larger goals that the Rambam sets out in his Moreh Nevuchim. He starts with Sefer Hamada intentionally, and he starts with the proof of God. He literally begins with theology. He starts with the beginning, and he discusses creation and basics of belief and the problems with idolatry and so on and so forth. All those cool core, not just the practice of idolatry, but pagan philosophy, right? And so on. And then he closes again with that intellectual connection to God in the Messianic era. So the Rambam is really enveloping or framing his halachic work with a philosophical or theological context and sort of arguing, don't see these as somehow disconnected. There are multiple disciplines and the two parts of our brain, our religious brains, can't talk to one another. Actually, they all form a coherent whole. And that's part of what was so offensive to people. You want to put it in a book of philosophy? Fine. We'll burn your book of philosophy. You want to put it in a book of law? I don't mean to, you know, be dismissive about burning those, but put it in a book of law? Wait, Sefer Hamada, you're telling me that I have to start with the Aristotelian philosophy to then talk about the laws of Kashrut? Right, that already, right? Tick people off, right? You're going to actually put in your halakhic work, heretical beliefs? I don't think so, right? So you can start to see why this got such a vociferous kind of response. And let's go back to this is where the schismatic issues come in. This is where they're burning the Rambam's books, not only his philosophical work, but his halakhic works, and saying this is not what halakha is all about, right? At least not this philosophy anyway. So you start to see yes, controversial, but ingenious an attempt this was, and sort of an implicit argument for a more holistic way of looking at everything, rather than sort of to piecemeal.
And he was just making a point. It's just, that's how he lived. That's how he saw it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We don't.
No, I think most of us don't. I would agree.
Sadly.
Very. Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's an issue for our community to think about. The Rambam thinks about mitzvot. He will tell you, you should do the mitzvah anyway, but he will also tell you that if you do the mitzvah and it's empty and it's not leading to this goal, then you've missed something very basic. He says that explicitly in multiple places. I think that this is a contemporary message for sure. Absolutely. Okay. That's just in terms of the larger overarching structure of the entirety of the Sefer or particular sets of halachot, but then even within local halachot, so we've already discussed this earlier this year, that there is also wisdom. So just to circle back to and reinforce an example we gave earlier, in Sefer Zmanim, the Rambam discusses Hilchot Shabbat. And if you remember up on the board way back when, we listed the various halachot that the Rambam discusses in that section. The Rambam has 30 chapters altogether, and we noted that the first 6 chapters seem to be quite unusual. The Rambam discussing the prohibition against doing melacha before Shabbat, the Rambam discussing the mitzvah of lighting candles, the Rambam discussing the laws of pikuach nefesh, of saving a life, without even having set down many of the basics of what the melachot are. The Rambam doesn't come to discuss the 39 avot melacha until the 7th chapter, and the prior chapters, other than the first, really 2 through 6, seem to be almost haphazard and touching on important principles, but there's no obvious internal coherence to the organization. What we suggested is that actually the Rambam is engaging in an implicit polemic with the Karaites and sort of meeting them halacha for halacha. You think that you're not allowed to do malacha prior to Shabbat and then have it remain. So for example, you can't have your candles that you lit before Shabbat and have them on. Not only is that permissible, that's the mitzvot of lighting candles for Shabbat. You think, the Karaites claim, that actually Shabbat is so important that it supersedes the sanctity of life. You're wrong. Pikuach nefesh is dochet hakol, and you put that right out there at the very outset, the beginning of the 2nd chapter out of 30 of Hilchot Shabbat, and so on and so forth. So there is, even in the internal organization of particular sections, there are, I think, strong indications that the Rambam was not just sort of, you know, playing around with it, or right, playing with fire, right? But rather, right, he was intentionally discussing those laws in a particular way for very intentional reasons. So just the level, and again, you can do this ad nauseum, but just to give a sense as to its brilliance, but also the larger importance of these kinds of studies of the structure of Mishneh Torah. Okay. much more to say about that, but I think at least gives a sense of the richness and depth of those kinds of discussions. Okay, we're going to move now to discuss his philosophical classic, the Moran Ibukim. So this is going to be fun. So what is the Moran Ibukim? Where did it come from? How does it relate to his other works? There's so much here. The first thing to say about his Guide for the Perplexed, the Moran Ibukim, is that it was, A, written toward the very end of his life. It was the last work, that's why we're discussing it last. So it was written toward his passing when he was in Egypt at a very busy time of his life. And interestingly enough, it was not programmatic in the way that all of his other works were. In other words, what I mean by that is that the Rambam did not decide, I am going to write a work of Jewish philosophy because I believe this is a work that needs to be out there in the world. He may have believed that, but that's not what motivated him to write this work. What motivated him is a series of inquiries from a student, a curious student who had been exposed to extensive amounts of Aristotelian philosophy and was steeped in Jewish thought as well. A student who was having a very hard time, was not local in the community, and started writing the Rambam, asking for clarification as to the apparent contradictions between Torah on the one hand and Aristotelian philosophy on the other. The Rambam does not write Moran Ibukim in one sitting. The Rambam writes a series of letters, which he then compiles into this work called the Moran Ibukim. As a result, the organizational structure of the Moreh is shockingly different than the Mishneh Torah. The Mishneh Torah is tight and super literary and incredibly thoughtful in its organizational structure. The Moreh Nevuchim seems to be quite the opposite. It's very difficult to figure out its organizational structure. Yes, there's an introduction with three sections, and there are clear sections, segments in which he discusses specific topics, but it doesn't have that kind of literary framework and tightness that Mishneh Torah has. In fact, there is a scholar of medieval Jewish history, Rabbi Ephraim Kannerfogel. He's a dean at Stern College for Women. I grew up two houses away from his and Tina. A very thoughtful person. He was my parents, or our shul rabbi when I was growing up, and then he went to Stern full-time. So I remember him once teaching about referring to the Rambam's organization in the Moran Ibukim, and he said that the Rambam's organization of the Moreh is basically similar to my closet. This is his closet. He says it's not very well organized. So that's a memorable way of thinking about it. And so there's a lot of discussion. What makes things even worse is the Rambam's introduction to this book. Because not only does the Rambam say, I'm writing it in response to a specific student's needs and questions, and not only is it not necessarily organized clearly, the Rambam suggests that his work, this great philosophical work, which is going to answer all the questions, right, that we have, all the questions of the student and perhaps others as well, that this book is riddled with contradiction. It's internal contradiction. As the Rambam says, what I write is likely to contradict something else I write in this very book. Mm. Now, this is a little bit complex in terms of how do we begin to approach a work that is riddled with contradictions. Now, some will say, there are lots of books, right, that are riddled with contradictions, right? Including even in our own tradition, there are times when Sukkim, right? Chumash. Seems to, right? Chumash, right? I think riddled. I think would be the wrong. Would might be too strong for okay. Chumash, and even for the Gemara. Great. But yeah, sure, there are contradictions, there are questions, and they need to be worked through. So even if not riddled, but yeah, sure, absolutely, there are plenty of contradictions that need to be figured out. Now, the Rambam, in his introduction, says as follows, and you have it right here, and just methodologically, it sets us up for such a range of possible ways of thinking about this work. Whereas the methodological questions about how to approach the Moreh are so complex and weighted, and they are such of a dramatic variety in the different interpretations of the Moreh Nevuchim in the larger sense of the term, because of this inherent ambiguity in what the program or what the project really was. Take a look on page 244. The Rambam writes, as part of his introduction, one of seven causes should account for the contradictory or contrary statements to be found in any book or compilation. As what he had said earlier is that there are lots of contradictions in this book, and now he's explaining that in this work, as in any work, there are seven possible reasons for that. So, for example, he writes, the first clause, the author has collected the remarks of various people with differing opinions, but has omitted citing his authorities, has not attributed each remark to the one who said it. Contradictory or contrary statements can be found in such compilations because one of the two propositions is the opinion of one individual, while the other proposition is the opinion of another. Next one. The author of a particular book has adopted a certain opinion that he later rejects. Both his original and later statements are retained in the book. I don't know if we would enjoy reading such books, but okay. Not a third. Not all the statements in question are to be taken in their external sense. They're to be taken in their external sense, while some others are parables and hence have an inner content. Alternatively, two apparently contradictory propositions may both be parables, and when taken in their external sense, may contradict or be contrary to one another. Skip to five. The fifth cause arises from the necessity of teaching and making someone understand. There may be a certain obscure matter that is difficult to conceive. One has to mention it or to take it as a premise in explaining something that is easy to conceive, and that by rights ought to be taught before the former, since one always begins with what is easier. Teacher, accordingly, will have to be lax. When using any means that occur to him or gross speculation, will try to make that first matter somehow understood. He will not undertake to state the matter as it truly is in exact terms, but rather will leave it so in accord with the listener's imagination. Okay? And then if you jump to seven, in speaking about very obscure matters, it is necessary to conceal some parts and to disclose others. Right? I'm intentionally being obscure. In the case of certain dicta, this necessity requires that the discussion proceed on the basis of a certain premise, whereas in another place, necessity requires that the discussion proceed on the basis of another premise, contradicting the first one. In such cases, the vulgar must in no way be aware of the contradiction. The author accordingly uses some device to conceal it by all means. Okay. And then he says, don't worry, I don't have all seven of these, I only have five and seven. I only have two. Divergences that are to be found in this treatise are due to the fifth cause and the seventh. Know this, grasp its true meaning, and remember it very well so as not to become perplexed by some of its chapters. Right? Okay, if the Rambam thought this is going to make it less complex.
Just clear.
Right? Just know that I'm going to intentionally write in a confusing contradictory matter for these two reasons, and therefore that'll help to clarify everything. Mm. So there develops an extensive literature of different methodological approaches to approaching the Moreh. And this becomes particularly acute because sometimes the Rambam will struggle with what would seemingly be a heretical idea. The Rambam will then present the traditional alternative. The Rambam will seek to reconcile them, right? And he will say whatever it is that he says. And then what you will have is the traditional commentators will say, okay, so the Rambam reconciled Aristotelian thought with Jewish traditional thought. He basically says that we can account for the Aristotelian philosophy or reject certain parts of it, but the gestalt makes sense and can actually be fit quite nicely into our traditional beliefs, Shalom HaYisrael. Whereas the more mystical or esoteric reading of the Rambam, and perhaps someone not steeped in our tradition or someone from a scholarly background or whatever it may be, and it's a secular scholarly background, might say, well, yeah, that's what the Rambam says because this is a political work. Right? The Rambam is covering himself. The Rambam is intentionally concealing because he wants the student to get the real meaning, but he wants everyone else out there because the Rambam is a public leader, right? This is a political work. And think about people who are in very public positions who have to be careful with what they say. We all have this to varying degrees. There's sort of a spectrum from 0 to 100, but we all know that some of us, either by virtue of personality or by virtue of our positions in the community, whatever it may be, some of us can or feel free to just say whatever it is on our mind without any, right? And there are ramifications to that as well. And there are other people on the other end of the spectrum who are constantly double-talking, and there are people who are hiding, and there are people that are hiding behind things or saying what they need to say and not what they... And it's complicated. It's not so easy to just blame someone for that. people have responsibilities and they have constituencies and communities and so on. But the point is that some would claim that the Rambam is actually on that extreme. And what the Rambam is doing is he's on the one hand protecting his backside, and he is basically, right, with the community. He is, remember, he is the appointed head of the Egyptian community. He's basically the religious and political head of the entire, right, of the Egyptian Jewish community at that time. He is, right, he is the physician, right, for the Sultan and the whole nine yards. And then at the same time, he has these underground beliefs that he's going to share in a secret way with these students, because otherwise it's going to be lost to them. It's actually not an incoherent reading of what the Rambam is trying to do. But then what you come to, if you read it that way, is that the Rambam will say one thing, and actually what he really means is just a little bit deeper. And in fact, you know, the Rambam means exactly the opposite of what he writes in his Moreh HaNevuchim. And that's what the introduction to the student was really all about. So this becomes a very subversive kind of reading of the Rambam, but it means something totally different. So let me give you an example of this. The Rambam, in one of the most famous sections of the Moreh, in 225, Chelek Bet HaSiman Chaf Hei of the Moreh HaNevuchim. So the Rambam there takes up the topic of creation. The topic of creation is a very difficult one, because there were two alternative views out there, neither of which seem to be consistent with the Rambam's view. I think we might have mentioned this at one point or another, right? The Aristotelian view is that creation is impossible philosophically, right? God is eternal by his very nature, right? And therefore, it must be that God and the universe are eternal, and therefore there's no such thing as creation. Plato disagreed, but in a way that still does not arrive at a traditional Jewish position. Plato believed that the earth or the universe is eternal, but that there was some sort of what we call in medieval language, in our tradition, chomer hiuli, some sort of halik matter, which was the essence from which God then formed or crafted the universe. But the universe, but in a kernel version, not in its roughly its current state, was again eternal for Plato as well. Traditional Jewish view is no, not yesh miyesh, not that something is created from something else, but rather ex nihilo, right? That has created something from nothing, yesh miyayim. Okay, so the Rambam takes up this issue. And the Rambam says, well, Aristotle has his belief, but obviously the first chapter of Bereishit, forget evolution issues, right? It's long before those discussions, but it sounds like there's a moment of creation, right? Bereishit bara Elokim, et hashamayim et haaretz, sure sounds ex nihilo to me. So the Rambam says, well, how do I reconcile these? And so the Rambam says something that already is pretty radical and has reverberated in many subsequent Jewish philosophical discussions. The Rambam says that had I believed that Aristotle's position on this matter is compelling, that it's right, I would have been willing to reinterpret the first chapter of Bereishit as a parable, to the extent that we don't need to believe that there's an actual moment of creation. But the Rambam says, I don't actually believe that Aristotle's position is philosophically compelling. I think that the evidence on pure philosophical speculative grounds is even-handed, and therefore, says the Rambam, in such a scenario, I believe methodologically, we should, instead of feeling the need to reinterpret the Torah, we should go with the face reading of what the Torah says, which is Bereishit bara Elokim, that there really was a moment of creation, and therefore I think that in fact that God created the world ex nihilo. That's my view. Okay, so if you just read this chapter, like you read any other book in the world, so what would we assume? Right? That it means what it says, right?
Pshat. That,
right?
Yeah, the pshat.
Right, right? It is what it is. But others, and a classic name I didn't mention, is those of the Straussian view. Leo Strauss was a great scholar in the mid-20th century in the University of Chicago, mid to late 20th century. Astro Marcus, I think he probably studied with him when he was there. And Strauss had a whole school of thought around him, and Strauss was the one who really championed the esoteric reading of the Rambam. So I don't remember, I may be presenting his, what I'm about to say may in fact be representative of his position, but I'll just say it as that school of thought would maintain something along the following lines. That what the Rambam is really doing is he's kind of, right, he's turning to the traditional community and he's saying, in an outward way, he's saying, well, right, he goes to the precipice. In other words, he's willing to go pretty far, but in the end of the day, he says, don't worry, I believe. Hmm. Right? Don't you worry. All good. But then what he's really doing is he's turning back to his student, who gets the Aristotelian philosophy and why it's so compelling. Right. He says, wink, wink, what I really think is that this guy got it right and he should reinterpret the Torah along untraditional metaphorical lines. Right? And so, does the Rambam believe in what he says or does he not? These are radically different readings of the Rambam. Right? So this whole discussion of the methodological or even political overtones the Rambam's writing becomes a serious issue. One point that is sometimes made, but I think not as strongly in support of the traditional view, and is important, is that there are many of the views, and this, by the way, we could repeat this exercise with many, many of the key issues about prophecy, about where else does it come up, about the heavenly spheres, metaphysics, all these kinds of things. You have very similar kinds of problems, which to us may seem kind of obscure and maybe even quaint at times, but for them, these were really burning issues. How Hashkacha works, right? To what extent, right? There's, I mean, that's the same thing as creation, right? I mean, right? Okay? As, right, exactly. So these are...
It's pretty clear.
Okay, what? Is this all... That's Hashkacha too. Okay. Okay. So this repeats itself, and this is sort of, you know, the big elephant in the room anytime you're reading the Rambam. To me, one point that is important to stress is that many of the positions that the Rambam adopts in his Moreh Nevuchim are also repeated in other works, letters, other writings, the Rambam, you know, Yachtamala, Pirush HaMishnah, and so on and so forth, including things that were written much earlier in his life. Which I think is really important in the sense that if what we're talking about is that this book in particular is a political work, the fact that the Rambam may have said it in other contexts or even earlier before he was looking over his back in quite the same way, that might well reinforce a more traditional reading of some of the views mentioned here. And that's true about creation, it's true about his understanding of the resuscitation of the dead, Tchiyat HaMetim, which is another one of these issues that gets hotly debated. The Rambam is accused of denying the literal meaning of Tchiyat HaMetim. And the Rambam writes Nigeret Tchiyat HaMetim, defending his view and saying, actually, I do believe in it literally, I just think it's going to be an earlier phase and that there'll be a later phase where the soul will outlive the body, but that first phase will be when the body is resuscitated and so on. So to me, if the Rambam, I don't mean to say you can't apply the same methodology to other works, but I think it needs to be taken in a larger context. Many of these find echoes from other works, and that may, in many cases, although not all, not necessarily all, reinforce a more traditional reading of the Rambam, but you get a sense as to just how methodologically difficult it really is to read this work. What does the Rambam actually discuss in the Moreh Nevuchim? So there are three sections to the Rambam. I'll give you guys a quick overview, and then God willing, next time we'll look at least one or two passages inside, and then we'll move to the Rambam's letters as well. That's where we'll conclude next time, God willing, with the Rambam. His letters, incidentally, as you'll see, are my favorite. This is all amazing. But there's something about his letters that brings him to life in a way that anyone to life, but in the Rambam, I think it's particularly well accented in a way that his formal works don't. So, okay, so what does he discuss? So again, he has the introduction and then three volumes. First one is the easiest to summarize. The Rambam spent about 71 or so chapters in the first section of the Moreh Nevuchim on, interestingly enough, biblical exegesis. And in particular, the Rambam redefines essentially each and every context in which the Torah seems to use anthropomorphisms. For the Rambam, the war against anthropomorphism, okay, and I don't use that term lightly, but I mean it very, quite seriously. Okay, the Rambam, there were those who believed that God, and all sorts of grotesque ideas, certainly for the Rambam, that's what they were, and he just literally wanted to have nothing to do with it, And this was what he wrote again and again, every single time. Yad Chazaka, and all these, and what does God mean that God speaks, and what happened at Sinai, and all these kinds of things. Systematically, the Rambam spends 71 chapters reinterpreting every other phrase, it seems, in Tanakh. As L'Dibra Torah Bilshon B'nei Adam, this is just the Torah speaking in metaphors, and sort of you get but you also get a sense of the Rambam of just how compelling he found the rationalist way of thinking about the world. We know about astrology. He wrote a letter, a broadside against astrology and demons and all these kinds of things and magic. Right. It's all the same. And he's
interesting.
The Rambam was nothing if not consistent. Mm. The Rambam was one of the most consistent and almost dogmatically so kind of thinkers in our tradition. And this is in particular whenever he was completely zoned in and total and absolute in his opposition. So it's very interesting. It's also interesting to see the ways in which the Rambam then starts to talk about this idea that the Torah speaks to people where they are at. And sort of this idea that there are the elite and the masses, which the Rambam is an elitist, right, talks about this a lot, and basically compares many of us to children. Because most people who read the Torah just don't have the sophisticated understanding to arrive at the real truth. And so therefore, the Torah writes in ways that seem to mean one thing, but in fact mean something else. Again, the Rambam here, interestingly enough, is writing a work, right, in which he is suggesting that he is writing one thing but maybe meaning something else. Mm-hmm. And then he is saying in that work, this is sort of a double negative, I don't even know what to do with this at a certain point, but then within that such a work, he then writes that the Torah is such a work. So this is, Russell, how do you interpret that? I don't know, there's a lot of, there's complexity there, it's irony, but then you start to see this elitism that emerges. That's the first volume, that's the easiest one to summarize. The second chelik of the Mor Nevuchim starts with the structure of the universe. The Rambam, the Rambam, of course, had a geocentric model of the universe, and right, similarly, he believes that the Earth is in the center, and then we have everything, all the spheres surrounding it. So Rambam gives you his map of the universe. He talks about the angels and has heavenly spheres, and this notion that the heavenly spheres actually, for the Rambam, in certain places, actually are sentient. They are talking, they are, if not walking, they have volition, maybe even free will of some sort. Very interesting ideas, which to us are very foreign, but that's because we can visit them. Whether the Rambam's metaphysics would have stayed the same had he lived in 2015 is an interesting discussion. Actually, I don't think there's a discussion. I think it's very clear that they would have been very different. But for the Rambam, his metaphysics had philosophical significance as well, and that's where it starts to get interesting. For the Rambam and many medieval thinkers, and that was part of the challenge of Darwinism, right? And heliocentrism and all these discoveries that one after another moves humans to the periphery instead of in the physical sense of the universe, and that has all sorts of challenging ramifications in terms of those who saw the physical makeup of the universe as sort of like a Renaissance sketch, right? Saw that as reflecting our larger value and stature. And so, what do you do when that falls apart? But the Rambam has that as part of it. He then discusses creation, which we had mentioned, and the whole question of creation ex nihilo, and then toward the end of Chelek Bet, he discusses a prophecy. And for the Rambam, prophecy is, not surprisingly, an intellectual connection with the divine. For the Rambam, it is much less. So here's a sharp contrast to Yehuda Halevi. Yehuda Halevi sees prophecy as about a charisma, which emerges as a divine gift from the Almighty. And for the Rambam, it's much more natural or organic. It's not an endowment, it's not a sacred gift from God, but the more that I connect with God, the more I'm in tune with His will, and so on and so forth. For the Rambam, therefore, it's a much more democratic view of what it means to be a Navi. Right? And it's true for Jews and Gentiles as well. Remember, Yehuda Halevi sees it as connected with the Inyan Eloki, that is, this genetic disposition of the Jew, and Rambam doesn't see it that way at all. For the Rambam, it's much more about my organic connection to God. For the Rambam, a prophet such as Bilam is much easier to understand. The Rambam says that, right? And you start to see how this would work for him. And it's a much more, democratic, an egalitarian kind of approach in terms of this philosophy of prophecy. For the Rama, in fact, he wonders why, of course, Aristotle wasn't a prophet. I mean, after all, if the greater my intellectual understanding of God was, right, the greater my metaphysics, the greater that insight and understanding, the more connected I am, the more prophetic I become, shouldn't Aristotle have been a Navi? I mean, you only ask this question in the Torah of the Rambam. We're trying to give a shir on, like, the thought of Rav Kook and, you know, or Ramchal and the Sila Isharim and getting to this question, why wasn't Aristotle a prophet? But this is the Rambam. And so he has to add and say, well, yes, I have to achieve a certain kind of cognitive understanding, and then there's an additional divine gift. So happens to be whatever reason God didn't grant him that divine gift, but really Aristotle should have been a Navi. Some accuse the Rambam of having thought he would have been a Navi had he not been given that extra gift. But that's, some said it l'shvach, and others said it l'ganai. Again, you see where these kinds of discussions go. Then finally, in Chilek Gimel, the third section, he discusses more metaphysics, the meaning of Ma'aseh Merkava. So he gives away these big secrets, but he does so, of course, in very obscure kinds of fashion. He discusses theodicy. Some really interesting discussions. Five camps.
What is theodicy?
Sadek Viralo. So he's got that. He's got Tamei HaMitzvot. He, interestingly enough, divides Mitzvot into 14 classes. Just like it. Mm-hmm. Okay. The Rambam likes two numbers. He likes 13 and 14. 13, right? 13 principles of faith. Right. And he's got 14. He likes probably even more. So that's here as well. Right? Because he has 14 three times. He has 14... here, 14 classes of Mitzvot Nemar Nevuchim. He's got 14 books in the Mishneh Torah, and he's got 14 Shorashim principles in his Sefer HaMitzvot in that introduction. 14 overarching principles that govern what Mitzvot you count, what Mitzvot you don't count, and so on and so forth. Why he liked 14, I leave for the esoteric mystical camp to figure out. I'm not really sure. I don't know what he saw in this number. But it is an interesting thing. And why he then drops to 30, or he had only 30. There's something here. We just don't know what it is necessarily. That's the reason for Mitzvot. And then at the very end of the Moreh Nevuchim, the last number of chapters, 51 in part 3, 51 through 54, the Rambam offers sort of summary, recapitulation of sort of the meaning of life and what it's all about and what we're here to do. That's where it closes. So that's the quick overview of the Moreh Nevuchim. Next time, what I want to do is to look at least one or two passages. I gave you one here, which is the Mashal of the Armon. Very, very famous part of his conclusions, 351. So it's not quite the final chapter, but it's in that closing section where the Rambam ties everything together, and he offers the Mashal of the city dweller and the person who's inside the palace and the person who encounters the king, and sort of how those are metaphors for all the different people in society and their understanding of the divine. Mm-hmm. And God willing, look at that next time as well. The Rambam's letters. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.